Okay, so I guess to cover it up, I want to talk. There's two things I want to cover. I'm not sure if you'll even get to the second part. First thing is I want to talk about the feminist dream. I'm going to paint out my own personal picture. I don't know, do you want me to do that? I might be invading a bit, saying how I think women are thinking right now.
As long as you root it back into this, it's like, yeah, because then you get into dodgy ground, don't you? I think it's fine if you do it.
I'll hold back and see if there's an appropriate place to put it up.
Rather than begin with women are all fucking corrupt.
Yeah. Let's not hold back in this, though. Let's not apologize, for example. Let's be unapologetic. Like, we're doing this for dudes our age, so let's talk as if we're talking to dudes our age.
Yes, okay. It's now recording, by the way, so you can begin.
Welcome, people. We're here to do Ion Lecture 5, is it?
Five.
What are you shaking your head about? You're shaking your head to the beat, yeah?
Yes, I was. I was quite enjoying that. It was beautiful.
Can you do some English rap? Can you do a young rap?
A young rap? Yeah, sure. Hello, lads.
Hello, lads.
Today we're going to read some Carl Jung. I can't do it. I'm too posh for this, man. I can't do it.
My name is James. I'm posh. We got young. And I'm going to make you toss off. We're going to piss all the women off when we start with our young bits.
That was pretty good, except why did you begin with toss off? Like, who are we tossing off?
I was trying to think posh. What rhymes with posh? It's like boss, loss, James.
One day these are going to be shown in universities and that bit is going to be shown in front of a lecture. So hello everyone in the future, and I'm very sorry.
This is our way of proving we are not pseudo-intellectuals.
bring some light to this harsh material, I suppose.
Yes. Let's get into it. I guess people, we're trying to beat around the bush because we're essentially going to talk about feminists for the majority of this lecture, and this is just going to be absolute fire. We'll probably get kicked off YouTube. We'll probably get kicked off the internet. I feel we may even get struck by lightning. It is this type of energy we're bringing to this. We're going to talk about the anima and the animus part two, and now we're going to start breaching into Jung's conception of the animus. That is the energizing power that is within a woman's mind. It is the symbol of the man within the woman. It is the symbol of the lover, the hero within the woman. And so we're going to break that open and show how that leads people forward and how that informs people. Now, the reason why these two concepts are important for the context of this book is that we start off with the ego and the shadow. And the ego and the shadow are very personal. The ego is your conception of yourself. The shadow is your conception of the things that you don't want to look about yourself. It's very much personal to you. But Jung was suggesting that once you get past the shadow and you go deeper into your unconscious, you meet with the anima or the animus, depending on your gender. And what happens with the anima or the animus is that you get this image of a member of the opposite sex, and it's got loads of connotations to it, but it's a very important thing about balancing out your personality. But Jung said that this image is informed by your mother in a personal way, also by the desire, that's a big deal about it as well, who, like, your lovers are often wrapped up with this. And what's most interesting then is it's wrapped up with the symbol of the collective unconscious at the time. So if you lived in an extremely Christian society, and you stirred a lot of soup or something like that, if you lived in an extremely Christian society and you had the Virgin Mary up there, there would be this connection to that. If you lived in a Greek society, Sophia would be right up there, or one of the other types of animas. You might have Eve on the lower level, whatever is the mythology at the time. And so nowadays, for example, you might have a celebrity like Jessica Alba or Megan Fox when she was big. All the guys were talking about Megan Fox. She was the Eve of that era. And then you might have Hillary Clinton as like another form of that in like a different level. I thought you were going to break into a smile.
No. It's like, I don't know how you could possibly compare Megan Fox in all her beautiful, perfect glory to Hillary Clinton. That's quite
upsetting. Hillary Clinton's a fox, man. Did you ever see her when she was younger? She was quite good looking.
No, I haven't actually. Maybe you should after this. That should be the thumbnail. Just a very young, sexy looking Hillary Clinton.
Maybe you should look again. Maybe I'm just being a bit weird now. Anyway, let's keep going. So whatever symbol is pedestalized in the culture informs the personal unconscious. And that's a very weird idea, because that means that there's something shared that connects with you and brings energy out of you and brings your focus, brings your attention, and is a holding symbol in the group mind. And why this is important is Jung is suggesting that the self, the final part, the idea of your soul, your totality, is held by Christ in our current age. And the reason why this book is scary is because it seems like the symbol of the self is at war right now. It seems like Satan or the Antichrist is coming back to try challenge Christ for his position. And this makes perfect sense if you think about how in the last 200 years, Christianity and Christ is essentially a parody now. And it seems like there's like a war for that position in the collective unconscious. And well, what does it mean if the Antichrist does, or someone with the opposite values of Christ, that would be a satanic figure, gets that pedestal and becomes the soul of mankind? That's a very interesting idea. But we don't have to get to that yet, because that's when things start getting really scary. Instead, we're going to lay the groundwork and talk about the anima on a personal level and what it might be like to have a Brad Pitt-like character that's informing all women about the perfect man. James.
I have to correct you and call you out as a complete charlatan, because we're going to be talking about the animus. We talked about the anima last time. Yes. Which, of course, is the woman within a man, the feminine side, we will say. Whereas today we're going to talk about the animus, which is the corresponding masculine element in a woman. What I'd say to anyone watching this, of course, is you have to... I would highly recommend that you watch our previous lecture on this one, the one on the anima, because we introduced a lot of concepts. I actually find this is probably the most difficult part of the archetypes of the unconscious to understand. There's not many good resources out there to sort of supplement, to sort of catch up with this if you're reading along. So make sure you go back and check up on that so you're up to speed. It's only an hour long or so it should be absolutely fine for you.
Beautiful.
I like playing the teacher role. I think it suits me quite well.
Shall we just go ahead, man? Shall we just dig into it?
I think we shall.
Okay.
To everybody, this is page 14. This is lecture 5. We're only on page 14. So
14, please, people.
So just as the mother seems to be the first carrier of the projection-making factor for the son, so is the father for the daughter. Practical experience of these relationships is made up of many individual cases, presenting all kinds of variations on the same basic theme. A concise description of them can, therefore, be no more than schematic. Woman is compensated by a masculine element, and therefore her unconscious has, so to speak, my friends, a masculine imprint. This results in a considerable psychological difference between men and women. That's controversial. And accordingly, I have called the projection-making factor in women the animus, which means mind or spirit. The animus corresponds to the paternal logos, just as the anima corresponds to the maternal eros. But I do not wish or intend to give these two intuitive concepts too specific a definition. I use eros and logos merely as conceptual aids to describe the fact that woman's consciousness is characterized more by the connective quality of eros than by the discrimination and cognition associated with logos. Do you have any comments, sir, before we press on, apart from the fact that my dog is very excited in the back?
The dog is like your anima shouting.
Yeah, it is. It's actually part of my psyche. That's why I'm wearing this cross, to try and keep the demons at bay as we dig further into this book. It's not working, man.
Yeah, you don't even have a dog. That's what's so scary about that.
Yeah.
This is a very important and difficult thing to get to wrap your head around. Is Jung is saying categorically that men and women are different, and he's also saying that they're different because of the opposite parts of themselves. So women get possessed by the ideas of the logos, and so they get possessed with, in the strangest way possible, reason, and men get possessed with eros, which is, I guess, feeling or love or intimacy. And what's interesting is that by default, men are slightly more cold, you could say. But as we described before, they also suffer from that Oedipal problem. So their particular hero journey is quite different. They need to man up to an extent and become a courageous hero worth winning the damsel, shall we say. Now, I think that the females... I think an easy way to access the idea of the animus is to understand that a woman is very vulnerable. Like, if she gets with the wrong guy, she'll end up having a baby and being trapped with a baby by some loser, or worse, some guy who leaves her. So she really needs to get a very clear model of what a good man is. She needs to have a hero in her head from a very, very young age. She needs to know what is the archetype of a leader, a warrior, a decent guy, a guy to give herself to, you know? And so I think the reason why the Animus forms the way it does is because Jung often said that the Animus was very much informed by the laws of the father. And oftentimes when a woman is Animus possessed, she sort of has this air about her where everything her dad said was right, and she'd never deviate from what her dad said. So it's a very pious version of a female. And I guess the reason why that is because the idea is that the dad, the father, the strong father, the correct father, would model in his, through being himself and also probably through teaching her, what a great man was, so that when she went out into the world, she would just obey what the father taught her, and then she would see a great man, and then she would immediately connect to him and therefore continue the lineage on. And that would be the ideal way it works. But obviously, if you have a shit father, it doesn't work out that way. Or else if you meet a psychopath who's able to fool you, it doesn't work that way as well. And so I think that's sort of why the animus in many ways inside a woman is representative of a speech role, a logical role, a logos role, a meaning role, and is very much to do with words. And this is also so interesting as well, is that women are very stimulated by words. I think I said in the last one where women or men are very, very, very visual, and women are visual as well, but apparently women's erotic literature sells really well for the reason that it's the word stimulates them. And it's so fascinating that that connects to this idea of the animus-like logos within their minds. So, James, what do you think?
Yeah, I think quite a few things about this, to be honest with you. I think immediately this highlights why Jung might be discredited in academia. So if you say you're a Jungian in academia, generally speaking, you're in some kind of fringe institution, or you just get laughed at, basically. And it's like, well, why might that be? So Jung isn't very politically correct. You know, this is the political saying of the times on the right, I suppose, is facts don't care about your feelings. And Jung was a clinician, he was a scientist. And that's what he cared about above all else. And one of the words or lines I just read out in there was, men and women are psychologically different. And then he outlined specifically why. Now, there are, of course, other reasons why they would be psychologically different. But the difference between anima and animus is a very big one. And it's obvious in your own life. If you go, the women that you meet, generally speaking, have more of an eros quality to them. And the men that you meet have more of a logos quality to them. And that seems absolutely obvious to me. So in preceding reading in this book, I'd like to lay out that we're going to be sticking very closely to what Jung actually meant. And we're not going to curb anything that we say in lines of the politics of the current year, which for people watching this is some kind of masterclass in 30 years time. The year is 2018 currently, the very end of the year. So very, very important to bear in mind, men and women are psychologically different. And if going forth with this, you have some kind of preconception that men and women are exactly the same, you're either not going to enjoy the material that we're doing, or you're going to have things smashed. So just be prepared for that.
Yes. Good point. Jung, the modern assumption that dominates most academia in regards to psychology is that we are blank slates. And we can be manipulated into whatever we wish. And Jung proposed, and all psychoanalysts, Freud discovered this, Jung and Freud proposed that we have a nature, a coded, inbuilt human nature, and this human nature cannot be fucked with. So you can tell people that they're something that they're not, and they can tell it all they want, but their mind will act the same way. This wraps in with the idea of evil as well. We think that we can program evil out of ourselves by improving our education systems. But all we can ever do is tell people you're irredeemably evil, and you have to do something about it. It's part of your nature, original sin, motherfuckers. Very unpopular idea, because I don't know why. It just is. Maybe we could go on that when we get to the self.
Oh, that would be very exciting. Very, very yes. exciting.
I think that's a big deal. I will probably, James is going to rein me in here if I go on a rant about feminism, but I probably will go on a rant about feminism at some point when we're doing this, because I think it is very useful tool for understanding what might be going on with that movement.
Yes. I want to make sure that it's grounded within the lines of the text. So obviously, if you go on a ridiculous feminist rant, I would really win. Otherwise, go for it, man. But we shall press on. In men, eros, the function of relationship, is usually less developed than logos. In women, on the other hand, eros is an expression of their true nature. While their logos is often only a regrettable accident, it gives rise to misunderstandings and annoying interpretations in the family circle and among friends. This is because it consists of opinions, in italics, instead of reflections. And by opinions, I mean a priori assumptions that lay claim to absolute truth.
That is so savage.
Yeah, I know. He's such a dick. Such assumptions, as everyone knows, can be extremely irritating. As the animus is partial to argument, he can best be seen at work in disputes where both parties know that they are right. Men can argue in a very quote, womanish way too, when they are anima possessed and have thus been transformed into the animus of their own anima. With them, the question becomes one of a personal vanity and touchiness, as if they were females. With women, it is a question of power, whether of truth or justice or some other ism, for the dressmaker and hairdresser have already taken care of their vanity. I'm sure you have thoughts on that,
sir. Oh, wow. That was utterly savage.
He's basically speaking in like dad jokes slightly, isn't he? He's like, oh, you're speaking in womanish ways. It's like the way my dad used to speak to me when I was young.
There's this common trope among men that women don't argue to find the truth. They argue to get attention. So oftentimes, if you can see people who develop negative relationships, for example, I often hear guys say, and this is a very interesting thing about relationships, is that you should reward your girl when she's being good and when she's doing what you like her to do. You should give her attention, because there's this kind of instinct in guys is that when things are going right, you kind of zone out and you're like, oh, everything's all right. And then she starts to complain, and then you give her attention. You're like, why are you complaining? And so what she wants is she wants your focus. She wants to feel like you care about her. She wants to feel you're in her presence. And so she learns that when she's cranky, when she's upset, she will draw your attention towards her. And so she, in essence, will teach herself, all right, the more I give out to him, the more likely I am to draw his attention. And then on the flip side, you've got to sort of see when she's being cool, being nice, being relaxed, not getting overly irritated at things, and sort of give her attention for that. And that will possibly reinforce it. It's not strictly Jungian per se, but I don't know, does that relate to anything we just said there? But it's like coming into that idea that men and women have a very specific dynamic. Men are almost like the givers of attention, and that's sort of the idea of the logos. The logos is like consciousness of some sort, and women are like the giver of feeling and eros, tenderness, touchiness, sentiment, and these type of things. And they complement each other in a very, very powerful way. But there can be I think Jung is saying that the masculine side of women, the side of women that gives attention, that projects attention, is not designed for women to do, I guess, what a man does. Like, it's not for finding the truth per se. It's more to do with ascertaining a goal. That's what I think he means when he says it's about power. It's about ascertaining attention, or maybe even resources, or validation of some sort. And men, they don't, I guess, they get touchy in a way that's not really suited to their gender at all. It's that type of sense.
Yeah, so yeah, because it goes against the normal, we'll say, the archetypal way a man and woman is supposed to behave, as represented in stories and mythology, and always has. So I just want to briefly go over this. With men, the question becomes one of personal vanity and touchiness. So, you know, when you're talking to, an anima-possessed man, is if when they want to make it all about them, and they won't actually like detach it and be rational about a particular idea, they want to make it like, you're only saying that because I'm fat. You know, the way women will behave, right?
I have a spin on this as well. I think what he's getting at here is, I think I've noticed it before, is when you get in an argument with a dude about reason, about ideas, when you're having a conversation with a dude about ideas, a lad about ideas, and what happens is he gets emotionally attached to the ideas. The ideas become his identity. And so what happens is you can be like, you know, you get an argument about the most classic one of all. You get an argument about Trump, and you can sort of try your best to be a bit more distant, rational, and say, okay, so say Trump is this idea and we have no skin in the game, either of us. And then you're like, nah, Trump's good, Trump's bad, or any type of, I mean, there was one Mexican guy I lived with. We used to always argue, and I was very like Jungian. He was very scientific. And it's almost like every time I learned how to argue with him by simply just attacking science irrationally from a distance, knowing that that would trigger him. And then he'd just get upset. And then it doesn't turn into an argument anymore. It turns into a slagging match. And that's almost like, I think that's what he sort of means there, is that there's a touchiness inside a guy as well, is that on a deep level, he actually doesn't care so much about the truth. There's a part of him that just wants to be accepted and validated and get even those darker feelings of power and supremacy or fraternity.
Yes, precisely right, because the anima doesn't care about truth. the logos would care about truth of some ideal, I suppose, but the anima wouldn't. Or if it is, it's a different type of truth that's not very privy to rational ideas. So that's what happens with the anima and what that generally looks like when it comes out in a man. And with women, it is a question of power, whether it's truth, justice, or some other ism. And that's why you brought up feminism. So when you see a very famous example of this recently is when Jordan Peterson was in a debate with Cathy Newman on Channel 4 in the UK. Yeah. You know, England is the best country in the world, first and foremost. He was in an argument with Cathy Newman, and the way she was talking to him was basically creating some kind of target in her mind and then attacking it purely with irrational opinions for the sake of having irrational opinions so that she would appear right. And through appearing right, she would attain power and glory and everything of that nature. And Jordan Peterson said afterwards, and this is how I guess the word anima and animus are sort of seeped into his fans, I suppose, which is a significant thing. It's not something to sort of throw away, because he seems to be like the gatekeeper for a lot of these ideas. They come along and he said that she was animus possessed. You know, so it's like that man inside her, the man, the logos idea inside her, completely possessed her. And the way that looks like is sort of irrational opinion, some kind of grand cause, feminism, veganism, you know, anything. On the left or the right, it doesn't matter. It's just the left one, the ones on the left are a better example because they're more prominent and more culturally prominent. They're more paraded around and given space, I suppose. So that's all I have to say on that, sir.
I do have something I want to drop in is, I guess we're framing the logos as the rationality and reason and truth. And I guess the reason why that would be is because a man is very much set to the idea of modeling, you know, the jungle and knowing where the animals are so they can go hunt them or something like that. Men are very...
And also consciousness is masculine. And God created mankind at the beginning of time, right? Purely for metaphorical, purely speaking metaphorically here in like a biblical language. And it was the logos that created things. It was the logos that created consciousness. It's that almost the will to power idea, I suppose. The will to go and do something goes outwards.
I think it is. It's that type of idea of planning and seeing. You need to see reality in order to plan to reality properly. Whereas I think women and the eros, the idea of them being back in the village, they're more coded towards the idea of the social reality, which I think is just as important. That is in no way less important. And so in many ways, the female truth is the truth of life. It's logos is almost like the truth of the model of the world and things like science and engineering and how things fit together and machines and systems and stuff like that. Whereas women are more coded, or we could say the eros is more coded to the drama of the social reality and your social position. And that's why the truth that matters in the social reality isn't necessarily understanding the inner workings of the tribe in terms of a machine, but understanding how to negotiate power and dynamics and how to position yourself well to prove that you're a person of value and all that stuff, and how to suss if a man is high status. That's another thing, is like, is this guy a bullshit artist or is he actually a very high member of the tribe and all that, and how to, you know, keep your reputation in check. And why I think this is interesting is because that suggests that the fundamental goal of Eros is in some sense to argue themselves into a position of power, and the fundamental goal of the logos is to argue itself into a position of power using the more objective means, whereas this is the more objective, subjective way of doing it. And so when I saw Caddy sitting down with Jordan, she was sitting there and it seemed like she was having the argument not to get to the truth, but to negotiate her position of dominance. And that's, I think, what he's sort of saying is that women more traditionally would yield to Jordan's opinions because Jordan is the male. So it's like Jordan's the idea of the high status male with the good opinions. And he would say, Cathy, this is what reality is. And she'd be like, oh, you're so smart, Jordan, I agree. But instead, she was in this position where she was like, okay, I'm going to tell him what reality is and tell him I'm going to battle him in this type of sense. But she wasn't doing it because she wanted to find the truth. She was doing it because she wanted to prove that she was better than him. And that's what I think he meant by a projection. And then what makes this even more interesting is I was saying earlier that a father informs the contents of that animus, the contents of that position. So the father would tell her the model of a good man. But why I think the feminist movement is interesting is because it's now a load of 40-year-old women who are, you know, writing books about feminism, and that's coding younger women about what is a true man. So these older women are like now coding. Now they're now doing the job of the father in the fatherless world. Our dead fathers, our dead God. They're now coding the image in the female mind of a man, and it's negative actually. And so when she sits down with Jordan, she's going to be more prone to being triggered because she's going to take all those fatherly positioned feminist talking points and then throw them at him. And then that creates this really, really weird tension between the sexes because everything seems messed up in some sense.
Yes.
That's what I just said.
No, yeah, that makes perfect sense. Of course, you have to go and take apart what it means by an ism and the motivation behind ideology, but that's probably a conversation for another time. I think that covers it in the context of anima and animus. Because, yes, I think we should press on. Oh, before I do that, one thing I've got to say is that in no way is Jung supporting, this would be a very shallow reading of this particular work, in no way is he supporting the idea that women shouldn't go into STEM fields, for example. what he's talking about is the logos factor is dominant in men, generally speaking, and the eros factor is dominant in women, generally speaking. And then it's the opposite of that in their corresponding contrasexual component in their unconscious. So I mean, you still get feminine men, for example, who tend towards the eros quality. So in no way can that shutting that down before that immediately comes up.
I think in order to cover our bases, in order to get plausible deniability, we do agree that everybody manifests as a unique individual with any possibility of any amount of traits being able to manifest in any type of person. You could get a female bodybuilder, a female alpha male for all we know. It can all happen. It's all possible. And we're not saying it's not. But in order to explore these concepts properly, we must ground ourselves in stereotypes because, in essence, these symbols are, in some sense, stereotypes. So we're going to talk about how men and women traditionally work because that's the easiest way to access the truth, because in many ways it is our nature. So this is the frame we're coming from. So stop writing your crazy comment, you fuck, and start listening.
And also, anyone who's calling me PC, go away. Right, moving swiftly onwards. The father, in quote marks, i.e. the sum of conventional opinions, always plays a great role in female argumentation. No matter how friendly and obliging a woman's eros may be, no logic on earth can shake her if she is ridden by the animus.
Oh,
often the man has the feeling, and he is not altogether wrong, that only seduction or a beating or rape would have the necessary power of persuasion. He is unaware that this highly dramatic situation would instantly come to a banal and unexciting end if he were to quit the field and let a second woman carry on the battle. His wife, for instance, if she herself is not the firing warhorse. This sound idea seldom or never occurs to him, because no man can converse with an animus for 5 minutes without becoming the victim of his own anima. Anyone who still had enough sense of humour to listen objectively to the ensuing dialogue would be staggered by the vast number of commonplaces, misapplied truisms, clichés from newspapers and novels, shop-soiled platitudes of every description interspersed with vulgar fucking abuse and brain-splitting lack of logic. It is a dialogue which, irrespective of its participants, is repeated millions and millions of times in all the languages of the world and always remains essentially the same.
That is so brutal, man. That is just so brutal.
Can I like my favourite line from that. Only seduction or a beating or rape would have the necessary power of persuasion. That's actually highlights exactly, it's basically the stubborn nature of these particular things. He's almost talking about them like he doesn't like them very much. They kind of annoy him. He's been like a dad who's like, your irrationality is pissing me off.
I wonder, because I don't think he's actually, like, he never struck me as someone who's like, doesn't like women. Like, he's not sort of Rollo Tomasi where he's like, they're just hypergamous she-devils literally out to get your money, and they're gonna, like, you know, they'll fuck you, and then when they're ready, they'll dump you, take your children, take everything.
Yes, I've never seen Jung write anything of that nature. No,
whereas I think Jung is just teasing their crazy nature. He's just like, oh, they're so funny, they are what they are. I see. this is what's very interesting about the situation we're in, is that obviously that blank slate theory and the theory and the fact that we have to use plausible deniability is a symptom of the fact that it's very hard to talk in stereotypes, and it's very hard to base yourself in these ideals. And I think Jung is just being sort of forthright about the nature of thinking that goes behind these things. And it's not like he'd probably say this with a little bit of humor of some sort. But have you any comments on this? Because there's a few things I'd like to say.
Yes, let me just briefly remind myself of Yes, so he was talking about the meeting of the anima and the animus. He hints at this. He talks about this a bit further on. In fact, he talks about it immediately in the ensuing paragraph, that the anima and the animus can meet in a man. So if a man is possessed by his anima, for example, and meets a woman, generally the animus comes up and vice versa, and then they generally clash in sort of some kind of sick, twisted, strange coming together of two weird individuals. But he's hinting at the stubborn nature of both of these things. It's not like you can access them and control them with your with your rational mind. They just are what they are. And I guess his dad joke opinion on this, where he sees like all the problems in families and things are often anima and animus clashing. So you can get the man becoming really, really touchy and upset. Oh, don't you be saying that to me now at all. And then you have the woman who's being like, Fred, why don't you take out the trash? No. Or whatever, you know, whatever kind of hyper-rational, hyper-opinion thing that you might come out with. And so he's almost creating the metaphor for us, so we don't have to come up with a metaphor.
My spin on this is, I think it's interesting because I think it's talking about power dynamics. I think this is why this is such an intense topic, is the power dynamics between the sexes are so fiery, because it is about power fundamentally, and no one wants to be polite about power. It's hard to be polite about power, but women need to test men fundamentally. And so women need to know if men have strong characters. And I think the reason they need to do that is because a guy can come up to her and pretend that he is the great guy. He is the archetype, you know, the great hero, the you know, strong, high status, charismatic, fun, all the right things. You know, he can pretend that, and then he could get her knocked up in one night, and then she could get pregnant, and then he turns out to be an absolute loser who's like doesn't have anything going for him. And so she needs to be able to like probe into him. She needs to be able to literally assault him in his tender points in order to figure him out. She needs to be able to cut through his lies and hit him where it hurts. And so women in some ways develop this ability to strike. And that is the animus in a sense. That is its function. It's probably its justified function, in that it's not there to find the truth. Objectively, like, what is the rational truth? She's not there to have a conversation about ideas. She's there to have a conversation and test the power dynamics, test this person's character underneath it. So it's almost like she's putting up this front of the ideas, and then like poking with your reaction. She's looking at all the irrational things. So it's more about, like, you know, Kathy Newman's putting her foot on the ground, and then when Jordan Peterson catches her out, she sort of, you can see her fragment and warm up to him the tiniest bit. She's like, oh, you got me, you fucking rascal. And she kind of liked it a little bit. She was like, oh shit, that was kind of cool. But then she goes back into her mode of some sort. And this would be, and this complements the male side of it, because then the man in his approach to the woman gets very tender, because she starts to poke him in the feels. She might be like, oh, what's your job? And then that's just a simple logical question to answer. It's like, oh, I'm an engineer. But like, there's so much in that matters. It's like, is my job high status enough? But then it's not even that. It's like, if I say I have a high status job, will she think that I'm trying to boast because I have low self-confidence? So how do I say it? So you'd lie. You'd be like, no, I work at a hot dog stand. And then that's you completely being irrational, but that's you understanding the dynamics of the game. And so in some sense, she is poking at your sensitive spots, and that's representative of your eros. And that's why the man's eros comes up, is because the woman like literally uses her animus to poke at his tender points. And so if he has a bad relationship with his anima, if he's a bad relationship with his feelings, if he has a bad relationship with life, he will easily cave and get sensitive, and she won't respect him. He will cook. He will turn into a beta. She will find the woman side of him. She'll find his feminine side and crack him. And then she'll be like, you're weak, I don't want you. But if she does that and discovers that he's able to see the irrational, eros-like feminine side of the game, see that she's not asking, what's your job? She's asking, are you cool enough to say something funny here? Do you take your job too serious? Do you take yourself too serious? And if you pass that, she'll be like, fuck, yes, I like it. He's cool. I like this guy. And so it's very interesting how these two things, we obviously framed them negatively, and Jung is sort of being a bit of a lad when he's talking about them, but I'm sure they serve a very important function. And that would be my thoughts on that. That was a bit of a rant. Jesus Lord.
Yes, it's I've got multiple things to say about that. It does beg the question. So obviously the psyche evolved just like the body evolved. So these things will serve some kind of function. It's not like they just exist in your mind and the sole purpose of them is to contend with them. It doesn't make any sense. So what you're saying basically is a deeper version of the idea of a shit test. Those of you who don't know what a shit test is, it's like if I ask you a question like, where'd you get that beard? The toilet store? It's like, I'm not asking you a question because I sincerely care where you got your beard. I'm asking.
No, James, it grew on my face.
That's a line from Anchorman, I think. So, where'd you get those clothes? The toilet store. But that's like a shit test. But I'm asking you the question not because I care about the answer. I don't want the same clothes as you. It's because I care about your reaction. And your reaction tells me what type of character you are and how secure you are. But the difference between learning how to respond to a shit test so that you appear like a sexy man versus this is the shit test one is consciously crafted, where you'll go and you'll look on your Reddit forums or you weird neck bearded fucks. And you'll be like, well, so how do I respond to a shit test so that it works out in my favor? This is an unconscious clashing, which seems to always work. It's almost like you can't fall. It's like if a woman starts shit testing you, we'll say she'll start using that kind of language towards you. And then you break down like a small, weak, wimpy boy, then you cease being attractive. You know, you would have failed the shit test. So well done there is a tendency to sort of take that and put it into the field of social dynamics and dating, which I'm sure lots of people watching this will understand.
Yeah, like I think that's what it fundamentally comes down to is you kind of got to give these things their evolutionary kudos, is that a woman, the last thing a woman wants in the jungle is a weak man. And the soul of weakness is vulnerability, sadly. And so I guess the soul of weakness is how you manage your vulnerability. That is the way you get to real strength is to be able to know where you're vulnerable, how to control it, how to expose yourself, like dealing with vulnerability properly. And in many ways, she will probe for vulnerabilities. And the ultimate form of invulnerability is having a character that doesn't take yourself too seriously in the social dynamic game. And so it would be, that would make sense to me why these things play this way and why a man's anima would form up and it would be like a soft little whiny girl and why Jung is like, that's so pathetic. But I guess Jung is sort of framing the dark side of these things, because the dark side of this would be that the woman's animus gets this sense that she knows everything and it becomes stubborn and it becomes too masculine. And then that sort of breaks the correct role of them, because the point of this is to test the man to see if he's a real man. But then when the woman's animus gets pathological, it decides that it's the real man and that he and that the man himself must be the woman. And so you're in this situation where the animus inside the woman kind of grows out of proportion and says, okay, I'm going to break this guy down on his terms. And then it just turns kind of weird and disgusting and not proper. And then it's the same with the man's anima. If that takes over, it literally wants her to turn into the male. And so you'll get that in a relationship with a guy too feminine, where he's always expecting her to lead. And I've actually been in this situation before. It's horrible because you don't notice it when you're doing it. But it's like you try to make everything fair, everything the same. You try to like negotiate everything. And that actually really lowers the attraction because the dynamic's wrong, because it's you're submitting to her will to some extent. And it's not the way the energies want themselves to be. They want, it's a masculine feminine polarity is what's supposed to be there. So it's super interesting, because I think it's super positive in its fundamental level. And I think what Jung is trying to say is that you need to dig through that and get to these fundamental levels, or else you'll have a pathology going on. And I guess my rant about feminism would be, I believe there's a pathology going on in the world on both sides. I think men are cucks as well, for which is naughty.
Yeah, so I guess an example is this conversation we're having right now. I mean, I'm clearly the man, I'm clearly the logos, and you're clearly like the weak little wimpy beta boy who's possessed by his anima, and every time I say something to you, you cry. So this, as you're watching this lecture, it is actually very heavily edited, because everything I say that Stefan takes it cries. And that's because Stefan is heavily, heavily possessed by his anima all the time. So that was just...
If anybody would like to comment below and write what you think of James's soft face, please comment.
Yeah, I get multiple comments like that every single video, but...
Fuck you.
Right. We've spent the last 35 minutes on one page. Let's press onwards. Jesus Christ.
That was good, though. I think that's really important, like to get these ideas grounded, because as you said, they're very complicated and they're very difficult, but they're very important to get straight. Like, maybe yes. If we don't even get past this, we can stop.
Yeah, that's absolutely fine. So pressing onwards, people, we're on page 15 if you're reading along, sit comfortably.
Yes.
This singular fact is due to the following circumstance. When animus and anima meet, the animus draws his sword of power and the anima ejects her poison of illusion and seduction. The outcome need not always be negative, since the two are equally likely to fall in love. A special instance of love at first sight. The language of love is of astonishing uniformity, using the well-worn formulas with the utmost devotion and fidelity, so that once again, the two partners find themselves in a banal collective situation. Yet they live in the illusion that they are related to one another in the most individual way.
Oh, what'd you make it, huh?
Oh, I've got, yeah, several things to make on that.
Well,
he actually, interestingly enough, he highlighted what both of them are in single words, which is, from all the conjecture we've been fluffing around with, where is it? The animus draws his sword of power. So obviously it's what the animus is all about. When you were talking about Kathy Newman, that's exactly what you were talking about. And the anima ejects her poison of illusion and seduction, which again is that sort of eros quality. But I like that idea of the love at first sight idea. I always come back to this idea. It's like, why do men and women exist? And why do masculinity and femininity exist? Because they exist for a reason. It's not just we somehow come out in two different forms and then because of arbitrary oppression, we behave differently. Because that's quite silly. You know, it's like with both sides of the yin yang symbol, and we come together to make a whole. So I like that love at first sight. They come together in some kind of sick sexual union. They're attracted to each other. I enjoy that quite a bit.
It's I find the anima ejects her poison of illusion is interesting, because I guess Jung is, I don't really get that. I'm not too sure I understand it.
Like, basically, he's saying that men are powerful and wise, and that women are just evil seductresses.
No, is he not saying that the animus comes out of the female? So that's the draws her sword of power. So she tries to figure out the dude, and then like, what does the guy do? Does the guy try create this image of him being like a superb alpha male? Is that what it is?
Yeah, I mean, how else are you gonna put that down? That's the only way you could put that down. So if someone comes to challenge you in like a power dynamic, that's how you get around it. It's almost being like a trickster. It's an illusion type idea.
Oh, interesting. So I guess he's saying that when the two meet, the woman has to be on her guard because she has to shit test the guy. And so what the guy does is he has to play the game properly, and that's the anima coming out and dealing with the seduction and being all, because that's interesting, because I would have imagined that love at first sight would have been way more based in the traditional genders. So the man would act super masculine and then the woman would act super feminine. And that would, but he's suggesting that it's the psychological flip.
Well, yeah, he's saying it's a special instance of love at first sight. So the way you're saying it still works. I think to be honest, in this chat, he does seem to be quite enjoying himself. Yeah. Like, he does like to write quite flowery. Have you got any thoughts? Otherwise, I shall press onwards.
The language of love being very uniform. So this is where it starts getting interesting in a collective sense. We said before that things like the shadow and all that, they're archetypical, but they're very personal. But the language of love, he's talking about the idea of, you know, Romeo and Juliet, the typical tragic romances. You know, like the way that all love novels and books are the same is because it's not necessarily like this pattern is so important for the human race. It's so fundamental that it's in many ways well worn. It's like walking, like we've just done it so much that you see it all the time. You sort of get sick of it. You don't notice it too much, but it's like you listen to any pop song and it's the same thing. It's like, I love you, babe, but you love him. And it's like, but I'm over here and I've got the money and blah. And then it's like, all right, I've heard it all before type situation. And he's starting to move this more into the idea of the collective, which is really important for what we're talking about. As he said, these patterns are shared, and that's very fascinating because he says it feels like you're having an individual experience, a romance, a tryst, meeting a new girl, and it's like, oh, she was lovely. But he's saying no, you're actually experiencing something that's super stereotypical. Like everybody goes through that, and you think it's unique to you, but it's actually completely hilariously the same. And I guess that's like when you think about it, when you speak to lots of women, for example, say you're trying to find a new girlfriend, you speak to lots of women, like almost all the interactions do follow a very similar pattern. It's like, hey, how you doing? Get to know each other a bit. Hey, what you do? Where you from? And then you start vibing in the way that we're talking here. You start playing the game. It's obviously not super rational, but then there are very set patterns to it. You know what I mean? And so it feels unique. It feels like you're meeting a new person in each of those contexts, but it's almost like the tracks beneath it are the tracks that your deep ancestors have gone through as well. So it's super interesting.
Yeah, I'd like to take a brief moment to talk about my anima problem.
Okay.
I'm being semi-serious, actually. But I it's difficult to know yourself if you self-diagnose yourself, right? But and quick note, when you said on the collective, you know it's a collective when it has emotional weight to it, because we all share the same emotions, presumably. You all get angry, it all feels the same way. We all get sad, it all feels the same way. So I think it's people who have depression, I suppose. I sometimes get ridiculously touchy when things don't go wrong. So when my logo's quality goes out into the world and keeps being beaten down piece after piece after piece, I will, when confronting, we'll say my fiance, for example, happens with other girls too, when confronting my fiance, I will go into like a, I will sort of retract myself, and then I will get into bed and I will lie down and I'll put my head on the pillow and I'll be like, no one likes me. And all that stuff. And I'll start being like a really menstrual moody girl. And I'll be like, I'm never going to be good at anything. No one likes me. All those mean people on Reddit keep saying I have a soft face. and I get really upset. And then it's something that takes over you and it's really inviting. You're like, why don't I think to myself, I'm like, why don't I stay like this forever? This is really, I'm going to be like this forever. And I'm always going to think like this. And then like the next day you wake up, you're absolutely fine. You're like, what the fuck was that? Like,
that's crazy. Yeah.
So I get like that. Probably twice a year or so. And it really, really worries my fiance when I come out like that. But it's like as if I become a woman. And it's like that's going to be some variant of the anima issue. So it's not quite the anima meeting the anima having some kind of power. It's like a performance in front of the woman where like the anima comes out. So no,
that's so things
about me on the internet.
Young actually gets into that later in this chapter, I believe, and he explains it almost exactly like you just said. Like thinking back to myself, I definitely do that as well, because I'd be very boisterous. I'd be almost like a little fucking puppy dog when you're hanging around with me. But then sometimes I'll catch this mood. My anima must be darker than yours, because my anima would be very like, that would be my sort of like thinking too much about Satan side. Like it'd be like super dark.
You're one of these, man. Protect yourself.
Mine would be brooding, man. And like even, I don't know, it's almost like mine is drawn to the more magical, the more occult, the more emotional, the more sad and somber side of things. And then my more normal, and you could say my more masculine state, is almost like sunlight. It's bright. It's like everything's a joke. Everything's easy. And I just feel like movement and these type of things. But whereas I literally see night and day in my mind when I'm thinking about it. So it's very strange. It's powerful. There's something really fascinating about that. And I've kind of learned that if I can sort of take that darker brooding feeling and pull it in, take part of it, and it deepens. Because the problem with the masculine side of me, you could say, is that it's a bit light, it's a bit heady, it's a bit ungrounded, almost childlike in a way. And you can kind of get the darkness, the heaviness, and this more moody side of myself, and it can add weight to it. It can add depth, and then you sort of get something that's actually truly, you know, a man of gravitas. It's deeper, and that's an interesting way that those two things unite in some sense.
Yeah,
so it's really cool. That was a cool story, man.
I mean, yeah, we both brought up our shadow situations and our anima situations. Maybe we'll bring up our experiences of being Christ later on.
Dude, yeah, I've actually a few of those. Like this is gonna be interesting.
God damn it. Okay, I will press on. In both its positive and its negative aspects, the anima/animus relationship is always full of animosity, i.e., it is emotional and hence collective. Affects lower the level of the relationship and bring it closer to the common instinctual basis, which no longer has anything individual about it. Very often the relationship runs its course, heedless of its human performers, who afterwards do not know what the fuck just happened to.
That's awesome, because that, like, that's, to me, like, that's him talking about the concept of the gods, is he says collective equals emotional. And like, why would that make sense? Like, that's a very complicated idea when you think, what the fuck do you mean collective? It means emotional. But in many ways, your emotions are like super low resolution. There's nothing really that unique about them. Like if I say soft face, you'll just get angry. Like, it's just, and then that's the reason why you get angry, is because it's like an insult to your status or something like that. And so that's a very basic trigger for anger. It's almost like a magic spell. If I insult someone's status, if I know that's the spell, I can summon Aries, or I can summon whatever, Mars or something like that. I can summon the war god into the room. And in many ways that is collective. And then when he goes away, he zooms back up there in some sense. And so when you're going through a relationship, it's almost like you've got Romeo and Juliet are summoning down, and it's because it's man and woman, and so you'll be like da 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 blah blah blah, and she'll be like it's like there's something very archetypical about it, and the emotions are very the dynamics very sensible, if you know what I mean. It just, it sort of makes sense how they're supposed to work. I guess I've looked into those pickup guys a bit, and that's what they seem to be saying. They seem to be essentially saying that women have a fundamental nature and a set of patterns, and you're supposed to perform a specific role in relation to that. You're supposed to be the leader, and this is how it works, and this is your job, and you've sort of not been taught this because society's gone all fucked and shit like that. But this, if you do this, women will respond to it this way, and it essentially involves being a leader. That's it. And that's because you're playing up to that dynamic, and it's really, really, really straightforward. But to put it into practice is different. It's interesting.
Yeah, you could sum all this up as basically, if you're a man, don't be a soy boy, to be honest with you.
Yeah, dude. Close the book.
I shall press on with this. Whereas the cloud of animosity surrounding the man is composed chiefly of sentimentality and resentment, in woman, it expresses itself in the form of opinionated views, interpretations, insinuations, and misconstructions, which all have the purpose, sometimes attained, of severing the relationship between two human beings. Oh, no, that's quite upsetting. The woman, like the man, becomes wrapped in a veil of illusions by her demon familiar. And as the daughter who alone understands her father, that is eternally right in everything, she is translated to the land of sheep, where she is put to graze by the shepherd of her soul, the animus. Such a beautiful man. I do love that he brings up demons and he brings up sheep, because both of those are like conspiracy theory terms. I wonder if he's trying to tell us things here. Don't be a sheep. Don't follow the demons.
And that's mad. It's yeah, fuck. The animus is the shepherd in the land of sheep. And like he's sort of saying, I think this is what I was getting at earlier, is she who alone understands her father. So that is like the dad models the image of the righteous man, who is, that's also like an archetype for God. God sets the moral laws in some sense. Like, I guess this is why nunneries would make sense, is that you've got the, I guess this is why people say that women have the tendency to be more honorable towards social norms. Because women just have that more conservative side of them. That's more natural to them. Like, they're not risk takers. Like, testosterone is associated with risk. And like, most women have had children as our ancestors, but it's only like one out of every two men that actually managed to have children. Yeah. And so that's interesting. Like, men are in some way like a risk. They, you throw them out there and they sort of have to, they have to grab the rules and they have to rationally think, are these rules of society truly the rules of the game or not? And then they have to figure out, how do I play the true game and how do I win? Whereas women are a lot more along the lines of, you get given rules and they accept the rules. And then they're like, just stay safe by these and learn to figure out a guy who's a good guy, who's got the rules right, who's playing the game right, who looks well, who's sorted everything out. And you'll be on the right track. And that that sort of puts her in a sheep-like state in essence. She is honoring morals. She is honoring rules. And that is sort of what I think he's playing at with this idea of the psychology. The words, the ideas, the morals manifest as the animus, the shepherd.
Yes, yes, I think that's exactly right. I can't add any more to that. I think that's exactly right. So, time to press onwards, my beautiful public. Like the animus too has a positive aspect. Through the figure of the father, he expresses not only conventional opinion, but equally what we call spirit, philosophical or religious ideas in particular, or rather the attitude resulting from them. Thus, the animus is a psychopomp, a mediator between the conscious and unconscious, and a personification of the latter. Just as the anima becomes, through integration, the eros of consciousness, so the animus becomes a logos, and in the same way that the anima gives relationship and relatedness to a man's consciousness, the animus gives to woman's consciousness a capacity for reflection, deliberation, and self-knowledge. There we go. So he's not just shitting on them. He says it's actually a good idea. However, sometimes they come out in family homes in quite a bickering manner, and sometimes they come out on Channel 4, and then Channel 4 gets 11 million views, and Jordan Peterson gets another $80,000 a month on Patreon.
It's interesting. This is interesting as well, because Jung He's never, this is never straightforward. Like, he's saying that these animus and these anima, they begin as low level conceptions and they're usually badly aligned. So men will often start off with as soft soy boys with a weak anima, and then women can probe them and make them crack. And then women will start off with this stubborn, a kind of weird animus, and that will have to mature. And as they mature into the wise old man, as it often does, the woman will become extremely intuitive. Because she'll be able to, she'll have this sort of higher form of reason than a man will ever be able to entertain. And this is actually something that Jung said is the reason why you get like mystics and people like the Oracle of Delphi and stuff like that. He said when the anima reaches its highest level, she has literally got access to, because her feelings are so intuitively aligned with her words at that level, she is able to speak almost as if she is the unconscious, because she's got this, her words, her logos is actually bouncing in and out with him. But a man's logos is always trapped within his individuality. So a man can only ever access Sophia, who is wisdom, who's a very, very powerful figure as well. But she it's almost like he can't break into the collective the same way as a woman can. And so that's a very interesting idea, because that actually is a massive kudos to women, is that women at the highest form of spirituality can break through and see the future literally. Like, they can just do something. It's so hard for us to comprehend. Whereas men can only really reach the level of prophets like Moses or Nietzsche or something like that. They can be these like great speakers, but they can't really do that super deep thing. And I find that fascinating. And again, this is what I mean, like, we're kind of having a laugh where we're saying, oh, Jung's talking about beating them to shut them up and all that shit, but like, really what he's saying is this stuff is super complicated. It's usually messy and wrong at the bottom, but when you reach to the highest levels, it's super profound and powerful, and the goal obviously is to do that.
Yeah, so something to keep in mind with this particular, well, these two ideas, anima and animus, is that they're both independent of you. It's as if they are a part of you, but they're also different to you. So as you were saying, they can grow and develop and change over time. So it's like, you actually do, if you're a woman, have a little man in the back of your head, and he's doing things and he's learning and he's watching and he's ready to possess you sometimes. And same thing with a man, you've got a little woman in your head, which I find very, very fascinating. But we shall press onwards. This will be the last one before we end this particular thing. So thank you, everybody, in advance for watching today's lecture. The effect of anima and animus on the ego is in principle the same. This effect is extremely difficult to eliminate because, in the first place, it is uncommonly strong and immediately fills the ego personality with an unshakable feeling of rightness and righteousness. In the second place, the cause of the effect is projected and appears to lie in objects and objective situations. Both these characteristics can, I believe, be traced back to the peculiarities of the archetype. For the archetype, of course, exists a priori. This may possibly explain the often totally irrational, yet undisputed and indisputable existence of certain moods and opinions. Perhaps these are so notoriously difficult to influence because of the powerfully suggestive effect emanating from the archetype. Consciousness is fascinated by it, held captive as if hypnotized. Very often, the ego experiences a vague feeling of moral defeat and then behaves all the more defensively, defiantly, and self-righteously, thus setting up a vicious cycle which only increases its feeling of inferiority. The bottom is then knocked out of the human relationship, for, like megalomania, a feeling of inferiority makes mutual recognition impossible, and without this, there is no relationship. Dun, 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 dun.
That's a monstrous thought in and of itself as well.
Right? Yeah.
What do you make it up?
Ah, that's terrifying, man. Yeah, so I was saying that the anima and animus sort of exist independently, which is actually, you know, it's not something to just throw away. It's not just a throwaway idea. Like, yeah, like you could say an emotion is like a different part of you, but it's not quite right. You know, emotions are like, you know, this thing, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. So that's complete rubbish, because words can summon gods, as you were saying, and gods can hurt you. So it's not the emotions necessarily that are the problem. It's something else. And the animus and the anima exist in your head, and your ego consciousness, almost, it doesn't know what to do with them, and they can be held sway by them. You know, when you were saying about certain moods and opinions that come up, that's the ego going, wait a minute, what the hell is this? And then this thing comes forth and takes over, because they are unconscious. It's like you aren't aware of your anima or animus. The only time you're aware of it is when it comes up.
So either it possesses you when you are, when you come up against something, it will project onto that object or project onto that person. And that's how you become aware of it. Or then at the same time, if you are an absolutely stellar individual along the lines of Jung and you've fully integrated your shadow, then you can go down and try and integrate your most, at least, of your anima and your animus that come up. So it's like there is a little person in your head that has direct effects on you and your life. And these, and what he's outlined in the chapter is these are the ways in which it manifests itself, and these are the things which exist. And I wish you would have kept going with this, but of course we've run out of time, because he then goes in on to specifically highlight the importance of that in the context of, well, Ion, we'll say, the symbol of the self, specifically what those things are, because it actually, it ties up into religious symbolism in particular.
Yes,
most fascinating man that you've ever seen. It's like these things are real, they exist in your head, and they influence you. That's all I have to say on this particular lecture.
I'm going to try riff on that last bit, because I don't think I have it properly cleared up in my head, but I do have thoughts. I think what he's getting at here is the ego is our the seat of our consciousness. So it's where we make rational decisions. And we have this conception in the modern mind, the ego, that rationality and consciousness is this all-powerful force that is like totally mastered all emotions and instincts, and it lives dominant over life in some sense. But I think what Jung is trying to suggest is that there was a time in the past where we had no ego, we had no consciousness. Ego is a recent phenomenon. And there was a time in the past where we were literally just a series of instincts. And the most basic instinct of all of those instincts would have been the unification of man and woman, or male and female, shall we say. It was the sexual dynamic. So that is our strongest instinct. And in many ways, once you hit puberty, that instinct comes to life. And it bullies the ego. Like you might have heard of these MGTOW guys, and they're trying to like pull themselves away from the sexual market, because they're saying, no, women aren't worth it anymore. And what's so interesting about that is a lot of their rhetoric revolves around this idea of get off the plantation. And they're sort of suggesting this conspiracy theory where they keep you in this like sex carousel to keep you controlled of some sort. And then nonetheless, what's interesting about that is they're essentially pulling away from a blunt train of instincts, which is the human desire to procreate. Like, it is, society runs on that. Like, when you kind of think about it, it's the whole point of everything. Like, it's like there was someone who said everything is about sex except sex. Sex is about power. And even what Jung's saying here sort of plays into that idea, is that the dynamic between the man and the woman is all about who can ascertain the position of power. Can the woman break the man and prove he's weak? And can the man assert that he is a strong character? And then that's the sort of sexual dynamic. But outside of that, everything else is about how do I get myself in that position where I'm at least having that negotiation? You know what I mean? And so, so there's like, there is this sense that what matters most is that you procreate. That's the way life works. And that instinct is so much more important than any conception you have of yourself at all. Your ego is a tiny thing compared to it. And so these giant energies, when they manifest in you around about puberty, up until you're like running into old age and you're starting to settle down now that you've had like many, many kids, and you're like, all right, cool, I'm going to become like a grandparent now at this stage. That massive force just bullies you around. That massive force that can take over your ego in any sense. You can be sitting there and you can be like twiddling your thumbs, being like doodly doodly do, and then a beautiful woman walks in. It's just like, what is that? It just happens. It's just, you're taken over. It's magic nearly. You get possessed by the anima and you're like, it's a fairy. Oh my God. She's so beautiful. And it's like, the frailty of your ego gets exposed in that moment. Like, you can't stop yourself getting a massive kick of just feelings. There's nothing you can do about that. And you're programmed so much deeper. And that's actually a really scary thing for your head when you think about it. It's like, I am not in control at all. At all. Like, I am so vulnerable to my feelings of wanting that. And in many ways, like monks and stuff with that, and MGTOW guys, that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to like reclaim their feelings back from that thing. And so I think what Jung is saying is that whatever is seeded in the collective unconscious, whatever way these basic instincts are modeled in the collective unconscious, whatever their symbols are, right now I'd say the anima for men is quite, it softens them for some reason. It is the soul of the soy boy. It's maybe it's like a loving mother of some sort. and the animus for the females is like a Trump or some shit like that. You know, it's like a monster. And so there's sort of, there's a lot of distrust between those two things, because those two things are fighting. And then when the men and the women find themselves in it, like not all obviously, but in any serious conversation about politics or something like that, these two things fire up and then they start fighting. And that's bigger than the egos. It's like, it's too hard to have an individual nuanced conversation, because you don't end up talking to a person. You end up talking to this war in heaven. And the thing is, I guess this is what's most important about it, is these two things that are in heaven need to sort themselves up out in heaven. And you, it's almost like there's, it's the same way sex can, the instincts for sex can take over you. What these two things are doing takes over you, and it's, you don't really have any power. So when they have an opinion or they have an emotion that they want to give you, you, it just happens to you. You don't really get to choose. And that's a very strange idea, because that can seem like stubbornness on the face, but that's more of a signal of someone struggling with the war in heaven, shall we say, between men and women. And that would be a good time to branch into the feminist and masculine dreams, but I will actually avoid that, and we'll talk about that next time. But yes, I do want to talk about that.
Yeah, well, I want to say briefly, what you said was very, very good, very, very good summary, but it reminded me of when I was in school, and I was quite a horny 16-year-old boy, as one is, you know, and that's fine. Shout out to all the horny 16-year-old boys out there. It's fine. It's not nice, but it's fine. And I remember talking about women to my male friends, although I'm not quite sure they were male at the end.
Women.
I was talking about women, and I was like, I quite enjoy the aesthetic appeal of women. You know, and you were saying that, like, when a beautiful woman walks by, you are possessed by this woman. And so some of my friends came up to me, one particularly ridiculously skinny soy boy, I was like, it's not normal for men to sort of talk about that. You know, it's like, you shouldn't do that. It's not normal, not normal. So if anyone's like a 16-year-old boy out there, you now know, if someone comes up to you and says that to you, that you can say that, yes, it is normal, specifically because of the anima and the and then you can cite this particular lecture to them, and then that will shut them up.
You, sir, having an anima projection, please fuck off.
Yes, exactly.
It is so fascinating how those archetypes and how they, and whatever is during our collective age has filled them up, dictates how the people build their relationships towards the opposite sex. That's so fucking crazy, man. That's so crazy. So profound.
Absolutely terrifying. But I think we should end this Ion lecture here. Now, I've forgotten that this is actually on Stefan's channel and not mine. So I cannot end the show. So Stefan, you have to end the show.
Oh, I have to end the show. All right.
You have to. It's on your channel. It's the law. You get all the subscribers, all the fucking glory, but you have some responsibility.
See, the thing is, all I can do is press record.
Oh, no, meaning I will end the show, but you can say, thank you, everybody, I love you, everyone donate to James's PayPal.
I'm not even sure if we're gonna edit this out, guys. This is a bit of technical fluffery here, but thank you very much, people, for coming to watch the show. Definitely put all the money in my PayPal, put all the money in my Patreon, and subscribe to my channel, and then unsubscribe from James's channel, and take money out of his Patreon, and write to him, you have anima problem, and call him Soy Boy. He loves that. And then maybe go to his Twitter. You could maybe subscribe there. Check him out on Patreon. He does have some crap going on there. And check him out on PayPal. And of course, his channel on YouTube. And we will talk to you next week, where we will go deeper into this animus dynamic, and hopefully get more collective, and maybe talk more about the feminist stuff. But that is a bit risky. And much love, people. Thank you very much. Comment below and tell us who you think is the softer face. Bye-bye.
See, I'm not even getting soft about that, because I do not have an animal problem. So fuck you.